Okay, and I think that the other thing that really impressed me over that period, I mean, this is, if you like, looking at the political and governmental processes, but there was an amazing strength in them. There was the pride and the strength. It's very difficult to perhaps capture well like this, but firstly, as I began to read back in the history of women, I was amazed that in that society, and I mean every day I saw manifestations of what that society was like in terms of how women were treated. But even in a setting like that, that there had been women who had been politically active since the last century and earlier, taking to the streets in their veils to protest politically against tobacco laws or whatever else it was. But then there had been an earlier move, but also then in the early 20s, I think, 1920s, when was the lifting of the veil?
34.
Okay, so in 34, it was decided that that women should participate fully in the development of the country, and to do that, they had to come out of their veils. And they did. And this gave them, I mean, in that culture, I mean, and what it means to go unveiled in that culture is really, I mean, to be harassed sexually. But those women came out, and so that when I got there, there were women whose mothers had come out. So they would be the second generation of women that didn't wear the veil. And that movement had been captured very beautifully in poetry.
Yes.
What's the woman's? There's a woman who and that move out of the veils onto the streets, into public spaces, into offices and things like this, without a veil and with shoulders straightened back was an extraordinary. Now, obviously, this permeated only to a certain extent, but nevertheless that permeation was going further and further through the society, I felt, when I got there. And of course it is true that in Islam there are many ways in which women have rights that women outside of Islam don't have. Mm-hmm. And so under Islam, women have the right to retain their name, the right to retain control over their own personal finances, etc., according to the Quran. And I think that also, given that in itself brings a certain independence, no matter what else is going on within the culture. So that I found a great strength in women, and it was good. I mean, just going and talking or watching in people's homes was always a very pleasurable thing. Now, I think during those years that I was there, this pride, I think that your appointment, the work of the women's organization, the role of both the Shah Banu and Princess Ashraf in pushing women forward in different spheres, in different ways, the focus on education, literacy, but education, girls in school and girls going through school, the economic changes that anyway were first forcing women out to work, began to snowball. I just felt there was this tremendous taking off, and so of course there was Damavand College, which was the college to give women tertiary education, and there you could feel it. Going out there, you really could feel this sort of the feeling of change that these young girls felt, that the world was suddenly one which they could enter actively. And I guess I'm now moving us from early 76 through to late 77. It's not that long, is it? Late 77. Now, early January 78. I by now had a bit of the language, but I'm not of the culture. I don't have the language well. I am an alien. So I only see so much of what goes on. I don't fully understand. I didn't fully understand things. But January 78, it was the anniversary of lifting the veil. I had done some work at Dhammavand, and I was asked to go as one of the key speakers for that night for the ceremony, marking and honouring the lifting of the veil. And in a few days before that meeting, the most extraordinary thing happened. And basically, briefly, what happened was that the word, the directive came from key imams,
ayatollahs,
thank you, that no Iranian woman was to appear unveiled on that stage, on that night, to celebrate the lifting of the veil. And then there was this long to-ing and fro-ing about whether I was going to or not going to, and also the discussion about at what cost, if we disobeyed and we went ahead, what would happen? And all of a sudden you felt a fear of a violent retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so at Dhammavand College that day we celebrated the lifting of the veil. I, of course, went unveiled and spoke about women and these changes, but all the Iranian women there were veiled and cowed, and it turned out afterwards were indeed severely attacked, because at one stage, I mean, these are women who had been out of the veil probably since birth. At one stage one of the women had let her veil slip back. And so it was as if we hadn't worn those veils, if they hadn't cowered. So the response was quite strong and brutal. So they then got a lot of criticism. And that, for me, in retrospect, signals the start of the revolution. I think for whatever reasons, I don't know how it came about, but there just came a time when the religious decided to start exerting brutal force to stop this pace of change for women.
It's
amazing.
Would you then how would you relate then the revolutionary event? How close
back to that? Help me out. I think the next significant change was the there was a meeting with a report at that calm, wasn't
it? Well, there was uprising at home that's
right.
Resulted in the student being shot.
Exactly.
But what I wanted to ask you was, did you feel during that period, and you were there until after the revolution?
Yes.
How much of the revolutionary events looked to you as if they were related to the role of women?
Good question. Okay. It seemed to me that there were, I think that, really interestingly enough, I do think that what stimulated the religious move then was what was happening to women. Women were just getting out of control, out of their control. And traditionally they'd control them through prayers and things like this, very much so. But women that they traditionally controlled were now demanding their rights. But at the same time, you had immense changes within the country. There'd been just a dramatic increase in rural-urban migration. The south of Tehran had expanded almost visibly before one's eyes. It began to be the case that men could not marry, couldn't take a wife because they couldn't find a house to take one. Food prices were doubling, each week almost they were going up, and people were beginning to talk, and the services were totally inadequate. Hospitals, schools, all those basic services were totally inadequate, particularly in the south. And in that climate then, one began to have to buy access to those services. And people started complaining very bitterly about not being able to get their children to school unless they paid, not being able to get healthcare service in hospital unless they paid, and so on. So there was a very strong feeling of discontent in South Tehran. Now, this then, I think, became the instrument, the means by which the religious forced the revolution. And what I saw them doing, the way I saw it, was, now this, if you like, was not women specific. The women were there and the women complaining, but that was men and women complaining legitimately about the results of a very fast pace of development that they culturally had not kept up with, that just governmentally had not been kept up with. So you had legitimate complaints. But what happened to those complaints was, as I saw it, was that each Friday in the mosque, the religious would, starting with those complaints which were legitimate, about which people were angry, would whip up that anger, whip it up and up and up till it permeated that mosque, and then they turned it and they directed it against the Shah. Mm-hmm. And in directing it against the Shah, they had to accuse the Shah of something to justify that twisting, manipulating of legitimate anger to achieve their objective, which was to get the Shah out. One of the things they used was what had happened to women.
Mm-hmm.
So always, I mean, it was the Shah's policies on women in schools, so on and so forth. There were other things too. I mean, there was alcohol. Carter's visit came during this time. The Shah appeared on public television, toasting Carter in alcohol. Mm-hmm. Disastrous when the mullahs were whipping everything up to frenzy, so it's just something else. But I think then that why, one has to ask, why did they move then? Because Khomeini had been calling on this for this to happen for over a decade. Why then? And the answer to that is because there were just too many changes, and it wasn't urban-rural changes or anything like this. It was women moving out. And how? Well, there was discontent, legitimate, and it was whipped. It was whipped up, changed and twisted, and directed against the Shah. And that's, people took the streets and the burning and everything began. So, I mean, that's... and of course it became... impossible to be a woman, mm-hmm. a foreign woman, a foreigner, walking the streets, and of course I lived up north and I worked way down south, right near, just up in the bazaar, right next to Foreign Affairs. So over those months, after Black Friday particularly, I think, in fact, this is interesting because now, all right, that's the macrocosm, but let me give you my microcosm, because I'm not sure that I ever spoke to you about it. I lived up north. I, in fact, was sharing the house of an Australian diplomat, another woman, so it was just the two of us in that house. Now, I think it was around the time of Black Friday, and I think that was about September.
Mm-hmm.
But everything had closed down, and we were up home, and of course a lot of my staff were women and non-Iranian women, and there actually were some visitors had come in. So it was a fairly tense time, so I had decided to have everybody up for a meal up to our house. And I did, and of course we had a meal and we were talking, and we decided to put some music on, and we decided we'd dance, and so we rolled up the carpets and we danced and we talked and we laughed and we interacted, and so that was fine. Now, and some guests stayed on overnight. They decided not to go through the streets, to stay on, so we got up the next morning and we sat up on the roof and had breakfast and, you know, drank juice, and then they went on home. And Robin went to the embassy, and that left me there. And I was sitting up on the roof, and I heard this commotion in the back streets. And eventually I understood that people were gathering around our back gate, and they were effectively saying, and of course I was speaking Farsi, so what they said to me was I had to go and get my chador on and come down onto the street. And it was already, there was a lot of them, but it wasn't ugly, but it was worrying. All right, so I got my chador and I went out onto the street. And what it ensured was effectively a kangaroo court.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were two women living alone and men visited us, we were accused of being prostitutes. We were obviously not Muslim, and therefore we were filth. And we had alcohol, parties, so on and so forth. Now, all this is going on faster, you have to remember. And the men are all around me, and it's getting uglier and uglier. Women in the background, and they have tapes of Khomeini playing, mm-hmm. September, and they put me on trial. Mm-hmm. And I'm having to repeat what they're saying in my Farsi to try and make sure I was understanding. But to cut a long story short, they'd got nastier and nastier, and eventually they said, if I didn't either convert to Islam and come with them to the mosque 5 times a day, or leave the country, by Muharram I would be murdered. I'd be dead. Now, and by the time they sort of gave the sentence stuff, everybody, the men, it was so ugly, it was so absolutely ugly, and I was surrounded, I couldn't get back to the house. There was, of course, nobody else around, and I didn't know how to get out. I feared for my life then. And the women were back in the second circle, and I had this chattel on, and I thought, I'm never, never, never going to get out of this. And so eventually I tried to speak to the women, mm-hmm. and tried to move towards the women, and eventually got through the men to the women, and they were still fairly ugly. But then my chador was not proper. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't have all those proper skills, but anyway, I'd been under immense tension, mm-hmm. and I wasn't that concerned that my chador was just perfect for the setting. So I got some of the women to fix it up, and that broke. That broke the ugliness, and then I held on to them and sort of forced them to walk with me to my back gate. That was September. So from then on, they would often gather outside and they would chant, or they would yell, or they would do this, or they would keep watch. They were there all the time, keeping watch. So, and we lived up on the hill. So, as that revolution progressed, this is a personal story now. You know, I'd be in my room at night, and I'd have a balcony, and I could walk out, and the lights of Tehran were down there, and the sky had the stars, and this chant was just going up to the sky, and I'd lie in bed, and I had a window at the back. Every time my curtain moved, I thought there was somebody there who was going to kill me. I mean, it was very tense. So that was all night. I got up very early in the morning. I had found out that our driver was one of Khomeini's troops, what they're called. And his cousin loved me, Mr. Mm-hmm. Javahiri. So the other guy who'd come in late to be the driver, he was pro-communist. Well, he was training, he was one of the militia. And Mr. Javahiri warned me that his cousin had said that he felt if he'd killed 3 foreigners, then he would be a martyr for the revolution. So, you know, 6 o'clock every morning, this guy turns up at my gate, and you know, you sort of, and we pick up everybody on the way downtown, and you're sort of having these conversations, thinking, I've got to establish links with this man. I mean, I've got to do it for the safety of all of us at that centre. So you had this stress all the way downtown. We got downtown quite early, because you had to get down early. And about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, then people would start moving up from the bazaar. They would surround that building as your staff. Mm-hmm. They'd surround that building, and there'd be machine gun fire and things like this. But we'd just stay inside. But then by late afternoon, they would have swept right up through. And of course, all the banks, the furniture was emptied out, the pictures, the shower, the streets were burning, the people were whipped up by that stage. And every evening, we had to take all the staff off, and then I'd be the last one to be dropped. So you're driving through, and eventually you'd end up I had to wear a shovel, I had to keep my eyes down whenever we're in the middle of a crowd, because you're always in the middle of these crowds with rifles and fires and things mm-hmm. like that, chanting and everything else. So you walk away all the way back up there, you get back up alive to the house, and you get mm-hmm. in the house, and I had this death threat all around me, and I never knew when I'd get through. I mean, that was just how. And I think that was similar. And if you were on the streets, of course, as a foreigner, was
your room with the centre? you think, instrumental in the way you were treated, or just simply being
alone? No, I think at home, I know, I think it was just that I was a woman living alone, a foreigner, so I was non-Muslim, and men came to my house, and they were rabidly conservative. They were following all those directives about the role of women. So that's why it was. So the revolution in the Bastille just marched inexorably on. There was certainly no turning back at that stage. And so eventually, I would have liked to have moved the centre out of Iran earlier. I felt our lives were in jeopardy. But in the world of realpolitik, the UN was not prepared to move any of its projects out at that stage, because it would look as if it were making a political comment about the Shah. And so we were kept there. We were the southernmost UN project and the most vulnerable, because we were all women. We'd been directly associated with the Shah's family, with Ashraf. We were in his organization. So they were very tense times, and it was just very tragic seeing what was happening. And of course, part of what you were seeing was that what was happening to the women, and even those same women who were quoting poetry and talking about their future, a very different future, those same women started going back to the veil. And eventually, Paris, Sofia Mohammadi, who was the deputy director, and myself, Paris would come, she would have been somewhere else, into an office or into a home or somewhere. All these women who formerly were so independent suddenly were appearing in veils. So we started a very informal project, but the aim was for Paris to talk as to as many of these women as possible. Try to understand why they reverted to the veil. And something extraordinarily fascinating came out of that, and that is, in every case, almost without exception, every one of those women reported to Paris that she'd had a dream. And in that dream, she had been told to revert to the veil. And either, the only variation on that theme was that in some cases the women dreamt of Khomeini, and it was Khomeini who told them to return to the veil. In other cases, it was Allah, but in one or the other. And all these women, who often were university trained or certainly secondary schooling trained, independent, often working women, had all of a sudden, I had a dream, and now I wear the veil.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
It's a pleasure. I'm sorry it's been so rushed.
Thank you.